Good morning. Thank you very much for the invitation. If you're not tired already of boundary layer clouds in the subtropics, I'll entertain you to another half an hour of that. So I'll focus on this transition. So if you take your, so these last few days have been great for this, right? If you take a plane from LAX to Honolulu, and you look outside the window when you depart, this is what you see, right? A lot of clouds, very reflective. Then just before you land, when you wake up or you stop looking at your laptop, you look outside, and this is usually often what you see, right? Puffy popcorn clouds all over the place all the time. And so yesterday, or Sunday, yesterday was not Sunday. No, sorry. So, this. So yesterday, no, Sunday, I look at the geostationary imagery for, so this is Sunday afternoon, evening, and this is what you see outside if you look from space. So this is California, and then you zoom in into Southern California and even more. And you can see that there is this transition indeed from a very large layer of stratified clouds, right, with very strong reflectivity, very strong albedo. And at some stage, there is a transition. If you make a straight line from, let's say, LA to Hawaii, there is a region of transition. But what you can see here, much more obviously than anything else, is that this is tremendously complicated, complex, right? There isn't just a nice climatological transition, as I will spend a lot of time talking about. The more you zoom in, the more structure there is, and Chris talked about it. So it does show you the challenge that it is when you're actually trying to come up with simple models of what happens and even try to bring those models into climate models, as Tapio discussed. Now, Tapio had a wonderful introduction about why we need to look into these clouds and understand them better for predicting climate better. So this figure does not do justice as the ones that Tapio put together, but this is one that you probably have seen many times, in which this is from the IPCC of 2007, but it might as well be from the latest one. You have predictions of global surface warming. Different colors represent different scenarios, so different amounts of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere that we try to estimate in some fashion. But the message here, of course, is not so much about the different colors, but that even within one color, and this sort of the thick lines represent the median or a mean of an ensemble of, I think, about 24 models, in this case, 24 climate models. But what this shows, that, let's say, look at the green one, which is a very plausible scenario, and look over here, this represents the enormous variability, or uncertainty, if we can call it that, in terms of the behavior of the different climate models in predicting global mean surface temperature, given a fixed scenario, given the same scenario. So, and the differences are from models that give you values of about 2 or less than 2 Kelvin warming in 100 years to others that give you over 4. So actually, the difference between the models is bigger than the signal you're trying to detect. So one of the things we know is that a lot of these uncertainties are associated with the representation of the clouds, and again, as Tapio mentioned, and in particular the way clouds interact with radiation. So those clouds, like stratocumulus clouds, those are extremely reflective and occupy a region. So now this picture is very different from the one before, right? So the one we had here was the instantaneous field of clouds off the Pacific. It's probably not too dissimilar right now. This one shows you a climatology of the cloud cover. In this case, it's from a particular data set called ISKIP, but it's not potentially very different from other data sets. This is up to about 60% cloud cover. You can see the region off the coast of California full of clouds, these long areas, large areas of stratified clouds, very reflected, as you can see from looking outside the window on an airplane. And then there's a transition from these clouds over here to clouds that are these sort of puffy popcorn clouds. And what I'll spend some time here is trying to understand the transition better, from very simple models to other models that are simple models as well, but are more close to, well, are sort of the stuff that we use for parameterization in climate models. But the hypothesis here is that, you know, it's likely that in climate change, the stratocumulus clouds themselves may not be tremendously different, or if they are a little bit different, that may not reflect a huge amount of difference in terms of the planetary radiative balance, or the cumulus clouds themselves. They may be deeper, but maybe not that different. But what may be different is this transition. So it may well be that the transition occurs closer to the coast, which means that you have less stratocumulus, less reflection, more solar radiation penetrating, and more warming. Or it's further from the coast. So this is sort of the main motivation in terms of trying to understand what's going on and why this transition occurs. And a lot of the things that many people over the last few decades have done are very useful. But we're looking at slightly different angles from before, although using, of course, the knowledge that's been accumulated. This is a almost historical figure these days. This is from a paper that is almost 25 years old from Steve Klein and Dennis Hartman that shows very nicely when they looked at different stratocumulus regions. And the stratocumulus exists off the west coast of every continent, so it's not peculiar to the Northeast Pacific, right? If you look at each one of these regions, and each box is one region of 10 by 10 degrees, and I think it's a seasonal mean for each one of them. And you plot the cloud amount or cloud fraction or cloud cover versus a stability measure of the atmosphere. So potential temperature 700 is, let's say, potential temperature above the boundary layer. The boundary layer in this case could be anything between 500 meters to almost 3 kilometers. So 700 is about 3 kilometers above the surface, as most of you know. And so the difference between that potential temperature and the sea surface temperature gives you a measure of how stable this boundary layer is. And what they show is that that stability relates very well to the amount of cloud. So the more stable it is, the more the difference, the bigger the difference between how warm it is above and at the surface, the more cloud you have. Now, this is not a new result. I mean, there's studies from Neuberger from UCLA down, you know, back from the 50s and the 60s when they did field experiments out there that showed this result. And there's a lot of work from Julius Lingu in the 70s and 80s on this as well. But this paper really sort of kind of created this excitement, and there's been a ton of work based on this. And so there is this empirical relationship, and what we'll show is a couple of things about this relationship and extend it as well. I mean, Chris and Rob Wood have extended this in other ways that are very useful. The other question, so there's sort of two questions that we'll try to address. One is this sort of large-scale question, and it's really about very simple models of the climatological transition and try to relate different climatological factors with the transition. Another one is about the physical processes, the sort of what processes can we represent that actually end up showing you a sort of thermodynamic transition that looks like the real one. And there's several things here, but I'll show just one or two things. So let's focus on this sort of very simple transition from a very climatological long-term perspective. If you look at a straight line, there's a straight line that we've looked a lot and we've analyzed models and observations over that line, it doesn't really matter, but if you look at that line and if you plot the climatology from ECMWF reanalysis of the different ocean surface heat flux components, so the long wave, the short wave, all from the atmosphere, by the way, the latent heat and sensible heat, this is what you get. So you get an energy flux that is about, you know, 200 watts per square meter in this region. This region is where we have cold temperatures. But in the region where the transition does occur from a climatological perspective, and so this region that goes from that point over there to that point over there is this region in gray. And you can see the sea surface temperature increasing steadily, as you would expect. And it's in this region that the cloud cover decreases from about 80% to about 60% from using different data sets. So in this region, what is actually interesting is that if you look at the net surface energy flux, it's very close to zero. It's between minus 10 and 10 watts per square meter from a climatological perspective. Now, bear in mind that ECMWF reanalysis, or any atmospheric reanalysis, does not have an ocean model. It's not a coupled system. It has a fixed SST. So what you see is something about the balance of these quantities in the atmosphere. Does that mean that the ocean has absolutely no response there? And that's something we can talk about, but we're going to build our simple model in this assumption, on the assumption that whatever comes out of the balance between shortwave, longwave, latent heat, and sensible heat, it's to first order close to zero, which means that it's, even if it's 10 watts per square meter, it's 10 times smaller than the latent heat and the shortwave. Now, in addition to that, the sensible heat is very small, again, a few watts per square meter, and the long wave is fairly constant. It's about 50 or 60, but it doesn't change much across the transition. So what actually happens in this transition to first order, or to zero order even, is that there's a balance between the amount of short wave that gets absorbed by the ocean, or that hits the ocean, and the amount of evaporation, the amount of latent heat release. So you can see here from different data sets, This is again that region of transition. That's the latent heat flux. That's the absorbed shortwave. You can see the latent heat flux going from about 100, a little bit less than that, to about 150 watts per square meter. And the shortwave goes from about 200, 180 to about 240. And so this is what's going on. There's two key variables, two key components. On the one hand, there's the SST that increases, and because the cloud is clapeyron and surface is saturated, it increases the evaporation and latent heat, and the relative humidity stays more or less constant, the wind stays more or less constant, so it's actually driven by the SST. To respond to that, and of course, this is a steady state thing, so there's no causality here, but in response to that, or at the same time as that happens, the shortwave is increased to balance that. Well, again, I don't want to imply causality. What happens is that you have less and less clouds, there's more and more shortwave radiation penetrating, and that balances the increases of cooling from evaporation. So in that sense, you can actually construct a very simple model that if you impose a bunch of other things, including how much radiation, solar radiation goes through the atmosphere, how much is reflected, how much is transmitted, and so on, we can talk about the details over the break, but if you do that, you can come up with an equation that is an equation that explicitly relates cloud cover, which I call A, but only in this equation. And it relates that, having everything else fixed, it relates that to the SST, that is the key driver on the right-hand side. So here you have an equation that relates cloud cover and the sea surface temperature. If you actually look at this, it compares well with observations, but that's not the point I want to make. The point I want to make is that you can actually try to build a coupled system, because there's another way of looking at this problem, which is to actually look at the energy balance of the boundary layer in the atmosphere itself. So the first one was looking at the energy balance of the surface. And this is what comes out. It comes out an equation that relates SST and cloud cover. If you look at the energy balance of the boundary layer, you can actually derive from very simple theoretical arguments and using LES a relationship between the cloud fraction and, again, to first order, the stability between the stability of the boundary layer, so the difference between the potential temperature at 3 kilometers and the SST. Now, we do know, and I've shown you in the beginning, that there is this empirical linear relation that from Klein and Hartmann and even before that, and for many studies afterwards, we know it's robust. So we now have two equations that relate the cloud fraction to the SST. So if we do have that, and we impose a bunch of the other things from a climatological perspective, then, and this is, by the way, the study that we did with LES that sort of derives this equation, derives the LTS relation from a theoretical perspective. But again, I don't want to talk about that. But if you actually couple those two systems, two equations, you try to find out, does it actually reproduce the climatological behavior of the SST and the cloud cover in the transition region? So again, recapitulating, you have one equation that relates cloud fraction with lower tropospheric stability, which is the difference between potential temperature at 700 and SST, and another equation that relates cloud fraction to SST through the latent heat flux. Everything else being imposed from ECM's referee analysis, you end up with two equations and two unknowns. We couple this system. We have to define these coefficients. We get those coefficients from reanalysis as well. And the interesting result in the end is that they do seem to behave in a way in terms of both the SST and the cloud cover that seems to reflect what's going on. So the first picture is the change in SST as a function of latitude. So this is the sort of the stratocumulus regions that the cumulus, and this is the transition region. In black, you have the SST observations. In blue, you have this very simple coupled model, which is a little bit too cold here, and that's because we have too much cloud. But for most of the transition region, it doesn't diverge from the observations more than probably 0.1, 0.2 Kelvin. In terms of cloud fraction, we compare three things here. This is not a great plot. I apologize. We have the same thing, so stratocumulus here, larger clouds, lower values of cloud over here. We have what we wrongly call in this figure observation from here interim, which is really not observation. So you shouldn't actually even show this figure because the here interim cloud values are not observational values. The here interim, the data simulation doesn't even really assimilate any sort of information from cloud observation. So it's really a model depiction of the clouds based on all the observations and the dynamics and physics that the data simulation system has. And because of that, we do know that this is actually biased low. So we have this other model, which is doesn't matter, but look at this red one as the closest thing to the observations, and I can argue later why that's the case. But what you can see is that the coupled model, the blue one, again, it's fairly close to the observations, and it is a little bit overestimating the amount of cloud, and because of that, you underestimate the SST. But what this result shows is just kind of, I feel it's interesting, is that to sort of first order, the SST and the cloud covers are they're coupled in that region. Now, this region is very far away from the upwelling and all of that, and the expectation is that the dynamics in the ocean may not be playing that big of a role. We actually investigated this by looking at ECHO, the sort of the ocean data simulation system, and I can tell you and show you some results that we have that do not invalidate what we show here. Now, let me go to the other side of the story, which is the sort of the what physical processes are driving the transition. And there's two ways of, I think at least from my perspective, there's two ways of looking at this. One is to look at this from a very sort of micro-scale perspective. What are the very turbulence processes at the top of the cloud that in the end make these clouds disappear? But, and we've done studies like that, but I want to talk to you about a couple of other things. One is a field experiment that took place, and I just want to sort of show one plot and sort of kind of advertise, and it would be great if more people look into this and get funding from the DOE to look into these data sets. And I'll talk a little bit about the parameterization aspect that Tapio introduced as well very well. So inspired by a lot of the questions that we've had in our sort of quest to understand what drives the transition, we convinced the DOE to actually have a field experiment which is rather different from traditional field experiments. So for those of you that have heard about the IARM sites, you will not learn anything from me. For those of you who have not, I can explain you, give you more details. But these are sites spread across the world, now they're reduced, in which the Department of Energy has a bunch of instruments looking up and trying to observe the atmosphere in much detail. And I think this was during 2009 when there was this big, large amount of stimulus funding from the government. The DOE got a lot of money to develop other IARM facilities that they wanted to put in mobile platforms, but they didn't know exactly where to put them. So I suggested, why don't we put it on a container ship that just does this trip from Long Beach or LA to Honolulu back and forth? And we did that. And so for a year, we have a full year of, not a full year, but almost a full year of observations of a bunch of instruments. So we have sondes, but we have a bunch of upward-looking radars, LIDARs, microwave, radiometers, a bunch of instruments doing this transition for a full year. So in that sense, it's very different from a regular field experiment. It takes place in the ocean, right? You go there for 2 or 3 weeks and then come back. This one is stay there for a year. We have all that data. The data is available, not always perfectly available, but you know, contact us and we'll be happy to help if you want to look at this. So this is another view of the transition. This is the cloud fraction. This is Hawaii, this is the coast of California. This is a different data set, this is a CloudSat data set, but again, the general aspects are the same. This is the legs, the different legs. There were several legs back and forth. Sorry. And this is a cross-section of what you can see from space and what you would expect the field experiment to produce. So bear with me for a second, this is height. This is the latitude again, stratocumulus, cumulus, and I haven't shown a plot like this before, before in the last 10 or something. What it shows is that not only the cloud cover, so this is cloud cover from CloudSat, not only the cloud cover decreases as you go deeper into the subtropics, but of course the boundary layer gets deeper as well, not only because the SST gets warmer, but because the amount of subsidence, the amount of air being pushed down, is decreasing, so it allows the boundary layer to get deeper as well. And here you have several different data sets. You have the CloudSat data set that shows this nice growth of the boundary layer. You have the ECMWF reanalysis giving you the sort of the relative humidity top gradient that is not too different, although you can see that it does underestimate the depth of the boundary layer. You also have COSMIC, which is a radio occultation measurement. And again, I can explain to you in more detail, but this is from space as well, that reproduces the transition, and this is supposed to depict the top of the boundary layer. And I didn't show it here, but I can tell you that this black line matches almost perfectly what you get from actually measuring it from radio sondes on the ship for the full year. Let me give you one example of what can be done with these data sets. And again, this is a plot a little bit like the geostationary satellite plot that shows you the commonality of the process, but it also shows you the diversity, right? So we have some sort of paradigm transition thermodynamic structure that I will actually show just before the end that we got from LES studies and now parameterization studies. But this is what happens in reality when you actually are going, you know, across the ocean from LA, which is over here, and Honolulu, which actually, you know, if this is to scale, Honolulu should be somewhere over here. This is about 20 degrees north. So these are different legs. And what you depict here is water vapor profiles and the radar, the cloud radar. So in terms of colors of the radar, you're basically looking at cloud, and the redder it gets, it's more precipitation, bigger droplets. And you do see many common patterns, of course, as you would expect. Otherwise, all our theory would be completely wrong. But you do see that the water vapor structure is, for example, very well mixed, as you would expect in the stratocumulus regions. And it's less well mixed. So it's well mixed underneath the base of the cloud in the cumulus regions, but then it undergoes this sort of unconditionally unstable layers. You have a decrease of the specific humidity. You also see this very strong gradient all the time, right? So this very strong gradient, it's basically the capping of the boundary layer, as you would expect again, very large decrease. And the clouds, as you would expect, all stop at this gradient. There is, of course, a parallel one in potential temperature. But you do see the amount of diversity as well. So although all of these legs do show a transition that some sort of bears some resemblance to what we would expect, you also see that they're all very different, right? So there is a lot of synoptic variability and sort of large-scale intermissions into this nice climatological process that we have in our minds. The Earth also shows a variety of other things. It, for example, shows the variability of water vapor in the free troposphere. In some regions, in some transitions, almost no variability. In others, there's an enormous amount of variability. So this is a unique observational data set, and this slide is actually to sort of advertise to the atmospheric scientists in the room that are interested in boundary layer and boundary layer clouds, that this is out there and is vastly unexplored, as Chris can be witness to as well. So in terms of trying to represent this, right, so what we're trying to do, of course, it's not just come up with very simple models that represent the climatology of the transition. As Tapio has shown with EDMF, and I'll show a few slides, we're also trying to represent what actually happens embedded into a weather and climate model. And so we should be able to, in principle, represent a lot of what's going on here. Now, in climate models and weather models, there's been this perennial problem. And again, Tapio and Chris even also mentioned this. The attempts to try to represent these structures that we're discussing have not always been extremely successful, not because people don't know what they're doing, but because it's a really difficult problem. This is a figure that I think comes from Arakawa via Bjorn Stevens. No, sorry, the other way around. No, yes, Arakawa, Bjorn Stevens, IPCC. It depicts the full transition. So imagine that this is California. This is Hawaii, and this is the ITCZ, and you have the transition from the stratocumulus regions, then sort of the deeper shallow convection, and then congestuous clouds, and then very deep clouds. And one of the most... Okay, I'm trying to find a good word, but I can't. One of the most negative aspects of the way we do this in climate and weather models is this modularity, right? In the end, when we build these climate models and these weather models, a lot of what we do is engineering. We try to put things together on top of things, right? And often we don't just go back and completely reshape things. And sometimes we need, sometimes we don't. But the consequence of this is that often you have completely different subroutines even in algorithms that do these different things. So in the boundary layer, there are models, and I worked with a few, ECMWF, when I was there. We actually had routines that would do stable boundary layer and then another one that would dry boundary layer. The stratocumulus mixing, at least in the 90s, was done actually in the cloud routine. The shallow convection was done associated with the deep convection, but separately as well. And of course, the cloud macrophysics and microphysics still is often separate. So you have all these, and Navier-Stokes is the same. A lot of these processes are all related to the same physics, but in the end, what you have is this very artificial modularity that has good reasons for existing. But this is something that, you know, a bunch of us have been trying to get away from. And Tapio, again, did a very good introduction to this. One of the tools or ideas that we've trying to push for is this idea of blending the mass flux and the eddy diffusivity in the same sort of integrated sense. We solve it in the same routines with the same numerical solvers. So try to be as integrated as possible. Tapio already showed these equations. But the one way to understand why we need both the diffusivity mixing and the mass flux mixing is, for example, if you do an Elias simulation of shallow convection and you do a cut in the middle of the clouds and you plot the sort of the difference between the mean between the total water at each point minus the mean, and that's vapor plus liquid, versus the vertical velocity at every point, you have this sort of two sides of the distribution. You have this sort of very Gaussian-like mixing around the puffy cumulus clouds, and then you have this skewed part of the distribution where a lot of the buoyancy and the water and the vertical velocity and momentum is present. So we need to actually have a, try to represent this in a unified way, but being capable of representing this different size of the distribution. So the approach here in what we've done, and I'll show you two or three slides on that. The reason I want to show this as well is because at the end, my last slide couples to this sort of climatological forcing in some interesting way. So the typical approach, Tapio mentioned the prognostic approach, which is a development, but the typical approach has been to actually assume the steady state when you integrate over the plume area. So we come up with this idea that the convection is represented by plumes, which is, you know, a strong simplification as well, but it's one that has been successful up to a point. And you end up with very simple equations that give you the growth or the decay of the different thermodynamic properties or of momentum as you move up. This is essentially driven by surface buoyancy, so you have a sort of a lateral entraining plume and a buoyancy production and a dissipation here. And of course, as you can see here, the key factor ends up being the lateral entrainment. Now, in our approach over the last few years, in our group at JPL, and there's different groups, there's about five or six groups around the world working on EDMF, our approach has been to focus on the idea of multiple plumes. And it's a very simple, so it's a childish cartoon of what actually we do. We basically do some sort of Monte Carlo sampling from surface properties, thermodynamics, and vertical velocity. Some of the plumes are luckier than others, so they can go further. We also have, inspired by a paper by David Roms and Ximin Quang, we have some stochastic lateral entrainment that is different from each plume, and it's different at every time step. And basically, there's a distribution that tells you how many entraining events a particular plume is going to suffer across a certain distance, and of course the ones that don't suffer much in training are even luckier and go further, and the other ones die, and or you know, die earlier. But what this does is that it simplifies a bunch of things and allows you to actually represent that sort of skewed part of the distribution very nicely. It avoids things like estimating the updraft area, because in our case what we do is that every plume has a certain size, and then the updraft area at every level is basically the summation of the plumes that are still alive up to then. And so we don't change the plumes. In that sense, we don't use a continuity equation for the plumes as a whole, and we don't need detrainment. So just to, before I finish, I'm going to show you a couple of slides. So let's go back to this skewed part of the distribution, and I want to highlight the fact that these multiple plumes really do well in trying to represent this skewed part of the distribution that you can see in LES, that is essentially the part of the distribution that is responsible for most of the transport in the cloud layer. So here we do it a little bit differently. So this is for the BOMEX case, which is a well-known shallow convection case. This is the LES joint PDF, so across the middle of the cloud layer, we do a histogram of the points. The distribution is highly centralized in the Gaussian mean around that represents the properties around the plumes. But then there's this very unlikely but existing skewed part of the distribution where the plumes live. And we also plotted for the same experiment where this EDMF multiple plumes would be located in this phase space, and they're there and they're representing that mixing. Now, in terms of the transition, what we did was to force the EDMF and the single column, so the single column model here is the EDMF. We forced the EDMF approach and the LES with the same sort of forcing to make a transition from stratocumulus to cumulus. If you look at total water, these figures represent in a very sort of smooth way what you saw from the, so here, if you actually go back to the real observations, you can see that, you can see hints of this, right? So a well-mixed boundary layer in water vapor, and then there is sort of a well-mixed underneath the cloud, and then this sort of conditionally unstable layer in the strong gradient. And you can imagine that if you do an average of all of this, you end up, and you do end up with something like this. with something that before we only saw in LDS and or once in a while sans, you do end up with this transition from a well-mixed stratocumulus layer to the transition when you have sort of cumulus underneath stratocumulus to a full cumulus layer. And we are able to represent with this simple concept of dividing the mixing in sort of more diffusive Gaussian-like mixing and this idea of multiple plumes subject to stochastic entrainment. We do end up being able to represent this transition. And I'll show you in one last slide that that actually is the case even when we force it from climatological conditions. Before, so Tapio referred to this as well. This is not part of the story. I'll just say something very quickly that confirms what Tapio said. One of the things we've done with the different DDMF approaches is now we can extend it to deep convection. And so you actually couple this to a microphysics model. In this case, we also have downdrafts. And we are able to, and other groups as well, to try to do to reproduce the transition, in this case, a transition of convection over land from shallow convection to deep convection. In this case, this is kilometers. And you do represent, so this is DMF, this is LES. And to a first order, you do represent the transition. This is just a very simple picture. But right now, when we couple this idea of the DMF with multiple plumes, we can do the full transition to deep convection as well. And this is ongoing work, as Tapio mentioned. Now, my last slide is trying to combine these two things. So on the one hand, I started by talking to you about the climatological transition and the forcing and how can we build simple models to represent that. And then I started talking about how do we represent models that are simple, that we can call parameterizations, but that we can actually use to represent the thermodynamic structure and those transitions. And one of the things that happens is that when you bring these parameterizations into a full-blown GCM, you lose control, and there's so many things happening that it's very difficult to actually be able to focus on a specific aspect. In this case, we wanted to see if the EDMF approach was capable of responding to the large-scale forcing without imposing this large-scale forcing into the model. So what we did was to run a bunch of this sort of multiple plume model, these EDMF models, in single-column model alone, along the transect between California and Hawaii, and we force this with reanalysis. So what we do is that we give it the large-scale forcing, we give it the SST, we give it the horizontal advection of temperature and moisture, we give it the geostrophic wind. And then we compare it with observations, and in this case, we're going back to this stability. So this stability is, again, the difference between the potential temperature 700 and the SST. This is a cross-section, so this is 3 kilometers, this is height, there's three different plots. This is cloud cover, this is from the cloud side observations. This is from the reanalysis that actually is forcing the EDMF results. And this is these are the EDMF results. And you can see, as you would expect from the observations, that most of the cloud cover in these regions, which are sort of the stratocumulus regions now, you know, notice that the plot is not anymore latitude, but it's actually just the stability. So this is stratocumulus, this is cumulus. And you have a growth of the boundary layer at the same time that you have a decrease in cloud cover. And the observations are, the EDMF is able to partially reproduce that, not fully successfully, but much more successfully than actually the physics of the reanalysis that is used to force them. So in the end, we are able to show that this sort of simple vertical models with multiple plumes is actually capable of realistically respond to the climatological forcing. And that's my last slide, it's just a summary. I don't have to repeat it, but it's really important for us to try to understand the transition. It may play an important role in cloud climate feedbacks. When we look at the simple models, we looked at two very simple equations that relate cloud cover and SST, one based on surface energy balance and the other one on the boundary layer energy balance that leads to the LTS relation. And we showed that the first order, the SST and the clouds in that particular region seem to be strongly and uniquely coupled, which is sort of, at least from my perspective, I'm not an oceanographer, I thought it was interesting and I talked to a few oceanographers about it. And finally, we tried to reproduce this thermodynamic changes of the transition using multiple plumes and diffusivity. And our latest result that we just got very recently shows that these models, these sort of simple models, respond realistically to the climatological transition, coming back to this issue over here. Thank you.
So I have a question, I guess, relates to the last slide you showed. Did you actually measure the SST on the cruise cargo ship at the same time?
Yes.
So can you put that in instead of the climatological SST coming from, and does that give you a different answer?
We didn't try to do that. No. There will be, actually, I have figures. We have a paper that we've been working on. I could show you the figures.
Yeah.
I don't think it's very different, no. Would you expect it to be different?
Yeah, because there would be a lot more small scale, kind of kilometer to 10 kilometer scale variability
right.
in SST.
Okay, maybe. But I've looked at the I've looked at the full year SST, and that sense is very different.
But the point
wise, yes, we should, yeah, I agree. But so this idea for the oceanographers, this idea that the ocean energy flux at the surface coming from the ocean, is that unexpected, that it's so small compared to the atmospheric components that it really can be considered negligible because there's basically no real advection in that region and the vertical mixing is presumably small. Is that what you would expect?
Yeah, I mean, kind of surprisingly, there are a few places in the world where there's a persistent kind of 50, maybe 100 watt per square meter net air sea flux over
right.
season by season out of the ocean. But most of the ocean is very close to zero, even though the individual
okay.
components are many hundreds of watts a square meter.
Okay.
Chris. So I had a related question then. So in your sort of coupled semi-empirical model of
yeah.
SST and cloud cover, what happens to it under climate change?
We haven't.
Make a prediction that's useful.
But we could use it. We haven't used it, no.
Are there parameters in it that are,
yeah.
or how are the different parameters in it sensitive to climate change?
So I wouldn't dare doing that because we do impose a bunch of parameters there. So for us, it was interesting to see how does this behave as a function of latitude alone. So if you don't force any of the models, you just force this. If you impose a bunch of stuff like the wind and the relative humidity,
mm-hmm.
And you just let the solar zenith angle change climatologically, do you get the right climatological picture? I think what we want to do next is see how much this could represent the zonal mean, for example. But I wouldn't dare to do climate change with that. But
I think you mentioned just trying to describe deep convection
yes.
With mass flux schemes.
Yes. Yes.
Does that, do you try to capture features like anvils and ice in such a scheme?
Right, so you have ice microphysics. In this particular version, we have very simple, both liquid and ice microphysics and mixed physics, really simple. We do have downdrafts. We try to represent some cold pool effects. And we do have a cloud macrophysics that Tapio showed as this PDF of cloud properties that would represent the anvils and the clouds that sort of detrain. Although for the LBA case, I'm not sure if that's a big issue. But yes, we do have the machinery there to deal with that. Although in the case I've shown, it's still very simple machinery.
Any other questions? Okay, let's thank Jared.
Thank you.